I'm going to open up with some remarks about the critique of natural theology that one finds in Hume and Kant. Then I'm going to make the fairly obvious point after a few... I'll adorn it a little bit. But then I'm going to make the obvious point that if you start where Kant and Hume start with their conceptions of substance and causality, anything like the medieval projects of natural theology are dead from the start. And so if we're going to resurrect natural theology, what we basically have to do is to at least have confidence that we're on all fours philosophically with the empiricist tradition on notions like substance and causality. So we've polished off substance pretty well, and so I'm going to spend the last part of my paper just looking at the contemporary discussion or kind of, it's not exactly a discussion, but compare Aristotelian, Thomistic Aristotelian notions about efficient causality with what's going on in the literature, at least the literature that was current up till about 10 years ago when I was working working harder and concentrating on this stuff. So I hope So there aren't any big subtle moves in this paper. Okay. One thing that did occur to me, though, when Jeff Brower wrote the list of topics that we had been covering in this workshop on the board yesterday, was that if you added a couple here and there, you basically cover all the topics that Suarez covers in the Metaphysical Disputations. I mean, obviously, we didn't go into as much depth in everything, but this really is a good introduction to, in general, scholastic metaphysics and to St. Thomas's metaphysics, because at least you're getting a little bit of all the main topics. The only other thing that we would want to get to more explicitly would be what analytic philosophers call philosophy of mind, what I call philosophical anthropology. But of course, strictly speaking, from a scholastic perspective, that falls outside of metaphysics as such. So, and we have dealt with that in the past, and I hope we'll continue to do that in the future. Okay, so here's my compromise, a paper entitled, elegantly, Causality and Ontotheology. I had to get it in someplace. Thomistic Reflections on Hume, Kant, and Their Empiricist Progeny. Okay, so the first section is called The Epistemic Pessimism of Hume and Kant. This paper is allowing me to do two things I always wanted to do. Read some of what I consider one of the best pieces of English literature, which is Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. I must confess it's one of my favorite books in the history of philosophy. I know. And secondly, to mention Pius X's encyclical Pascendi. So I'm about to do both of those in a philosophical paper. In part one of David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, Demia explains that he shelters his wards from natural theology until they have become thoroughly familiar with the other parts of philosophy, and hence thoroughly familiar with the weakness of human reason, even in mundane matters. Philo heartily commends Demia in these words, quote, "Let us become thoroughly sensible of the weakness, blindness, and narrow limits of human reason. Let us duly consider its uncertainty and endless contrarieties, even if in subjects of common life and practice. Let the errors and deceits of our very senses be set before us, the insuperable difficulties which attend first principles in all systems, the contradictions which adhere to the very ideas of matter, cause and effect, extension, space, time and motion, and in a word, quantity of all kinds, the object of the only science that can fairly pretend to any certainty or evidence. When these topics are displayed in their full light, as they are by some philosophers and almost all divines, Who can retain such confidence in this frail faculty of reason as to pay any regard to its determinations in points so sublime, so abstruse, so remote from common life and experience? When the coherence of the parts of a stone, or even that composition of parts which renders it extended, when these familiar objects, I say, are so inexplicable and contain circumstances so repugnant and contradictory, with what assurance can we decide concerning the origin of worlds, or trace their history from eternity to eternity? Even correcting for Cleanthes' insistence on the stellar intellectual achievements of Newtonian physics, Philo insists near the end of part one, quote, "But when we look beyond human affairs and the properties of the surrounding bodies, when we carry our speculations into the two eternities before and after the present state of things, into the creation and formation of the universe, the existence and properties of spirits, the powers and operations of one universal spirit, existing without beginning and without end, omnipotent, omniscient, immutable, infinite, and incomprehensible, we must be far removed from the smallest tendency to skepticism, not to be apprehensive that we have here got quite beyond the reach of our faculties. So long as we confine our speculations to trade or morals or politics or criticism, we make appeals every moment to common sense and experience, which strengthen our philosophical conclusions and remove, at least in part, the suspicion which we so justly entertain with regard to every reasoning that is very subtle and refined. But in theological reasonings, we have not this advantage. While at the same time we are employed upon objects which, we must be sensible, are too large for our grasp, and of all others require most to be familiarized to our apprehension, we are like foreigners in a strange country, to whom everything must seem suspicious, and who are in danger every moment of transgressing against the laws and customs of the people with whom they live and converse. We know not how far we ought to trust our vulgar methods of reasoning in such a subject." That's beautiful. Philo even detects priestcraft in the fact that the clergy go from being skeptics in one age to extolling reason in the next. This all helps, of course, quote, "in giving them an ascendant over mankind, though to what end we are not told." Nor apparently does it occur to him that at some times and places, natural cognition might be excessively exalted, while at others it might be excessively denigrated. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Catholic Church saw modernism as its main intellectual enemy. Hence Pius IX's encyclical Pascendi Dominici Gregis, which denounces cognitive overreach of all stripes. In the late 20th and early 21st century, it was postmodernism. Hence John Paul II's encyclical Fides Ratio, which urges all people, especially young people, not to fall into a debilitating distrust of reason. Yet the two encyclicals, different as they may be in emphasis, seem fully consonant with one another. Be that as it may, what concerns me here most is not Philo's tawdry rhetoric so much as his deep epistemic pessimism. Like Simonides, the ancient poet, he urges us to keep our eyes fixed firmly on the mundane and to resist the temptation to look up to the heavens. I can't help being reminded of the woman in Luke's gospel who had been bent over for 18 years before Jesus, quote, "made her straight and able to gaze upward." In fact, Hume's pessimism about natural theology begins with his treatment, expounded in other texts, of substance and causality. Whatever else might be said about his analysis, it is clear that by his reckoning, the notions substance and cause are second order, or if you will, theoretical ideas that help us order the direct objects of sensation, but that do not rationally underwrite a belief in alleged real-world natural kinds or substantial forms or agency or powers of the sort subscribed to by the Aristotelian scholastics. Given the centrality of all of these entities to a well-thought-out natural theology like that of Thomas Aquinas or Duns Scotus or Francisco Suarez, the project of natural theology is doomed to failure from the start. I'll return to this point shortly, but given my assignment, I first want to make a few comments about Kant. Kant famously remarked that he had been awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume, perhaps. But the truth is that, parading under the umbrella of epistemic humility, Kant did little more than codify Hume's pessimism by building it into the very structure of human theoretical reason. In short, Kant painted a picture within which the reach of human theoretical reason is limited by its very nature to how things appear sensuously to us, as he puts it, where these appearances are conceived of along Humean lines in such a way that they give us no access at all to how things are in themselves. More specifically, the category substance and cause automatically and ineluctably organize our sensuous experience and help us form expectations about the future, but they have, as far as we are entitled to infer, no applications at all to the things in themselves. This by itself rules out the project of natural theology, since God, the perfect being, or in Kant's terminology, the ens realissimum, is according to Kant neither a possible object of our experience nor accessible through the objects of our experience. Still, when we turn to Kant's specific discussion of what he calls the cosmological argument for the existence of God, we are bound to be disappointed. Well, I was anyway. At the very least, this section of the Critique of Pure Reason is much less impressive and much less engaging than the corresponding part of Hume's dialogues. Kant focuses mainly on the transition from the existence of a necessary being to the existence of a perfect being, or ens realissimum. On Kant's reckoning, this transition is licit only if one is already presupposing the existence of a perfect being, hence his famous and dubious claim that the cosmological argument depends on Descartes' version of, and I guess it would be the fifth meditation version of, the ontological argument, which he's already refuted to his satisfaction. Like Hume before him, Kant seems blithely unaware of the elaborate three-stage treatment of God in Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 1, where St. Thomas, having rejected St. Anselm's ontological argument, arrives at a perfect being only after a long and meticulously reasoned via remotionis that takes off from the existence of a godlike unmoved mover or unactualized actualizer. Of course, as noted above, both Hume and Kant had already rejected, either explicitly or through culpable ignorance, the cluster of Thomistic Aristotelian notions that St. Thomas had used to construct his natural theology. In the rest of this presentation, I want to focus on this rejection, especially as it pertains to causality. For the sake of simplicity, I will concentrate on Hume and his empiricist progeny and leave Kant to the side, though on the issues that are relevant here, Hume and Kant are pretty much of one mind. Now, there are two fundamental empiricist dogmas that underlie the Humean treatment of causality. The first, common to all of early modern philosophy, is that the direct objects of human cognition are themselves mental. I don't understand why anyone would accept this, but the people in my department who teach early modern, I say this to them and they look at me like, what's the alternative? You know, like, this immediately puts the reliability of our cognitive faculties into question, since there's no prior guarantee that the world outside our minds is anything like the objects of our direct cognition. The story of early modern philosophy features one after another attempt, often wonderful, creative, delightful attempt, to deal with this apparent gap between our so-called ideas and the extramental world that they seem to represent. This, to my mind, is one of the worst mistakes in the history of philosophy, right up there with Scotus's distinction between the affectio commodi and the affectio justitiae. You know, oh, come on, guys. This is what happens when you retire. You lose a sense of, you know, what's going to work with your audience. But it's a mistake that St. Thomas, for one, repudiated on many occasions by insisting that the intelligible species that shape our intellect into acts of understanding are not themselves the first object of our cognition, but are instead the means by which we have direct cognitive contact with extramental reality. I mean, that's as big a divide as you get in the history of philosophy, so I think, you know. There can't be much commerce. Well, I'm going to say that in a second, so let's keep going here. The second dogma depends on the first but goes beyond it. It's that the concepts associated with substance and causality in particular are in effect theoretical constructs that organize our sensuous experience but do not, as far as we can tell, take us beyond that sensuous experience to the real world. At the very least, our ordinary talk of substance and causality, far from serving as, in effect, a first principle, a starting point for the systematic study of the material world and ultimately of the divine, is itself part of a theoretical extrapolation from the raw, and in Hume's case, the very raw, data of the senses. I'll say more about this in a moment. There's just a big, deep divide between A, those who take the world as described in ordinary language as itself a given, indeed as a gift, reliably delivered up by our cognitive faculties, and B, those who insist that we are given nothing but raw sense data that put us, or should put us, into an immediate epistemic conundrum. No definitive adjudication of this dispute seems, to me anyway, to be possible. As Chesterton hinted in Orthodoxy, there is a sort of faith involved on both sides. However, in the rest of this presentation, what I'd like to do would be to at least illuminate the landscape so that we might better understand what's at stake in the debate between Thomistic Aristotelians and empiricists, at least over the nature of efficient causality. So we've now covered all four causes in this workshop. Well, we will have once I get going here. Okay. Even though I'll raise some criticisms of empiricism, my remarks are really intended mainly to underscore the fundamental differences between the two types of accounts. Throughout this section, I'll use causal terms to designate efficient causality and its empiricist surrogates, and I'll assume that talk of so-called event causation can be translated by Thomistic Aristotelians into talk of agents exercising powers, communicating being by action, okay, which is the fundamental notion here. Okay. I'm first going to lay out what I take to be three central theses of Aristotelian treatments of causality. The first thesis is that causality itself cannot be analyzed reductively by means of non-causal concepts such as regular conjunction or counterfactual dependence. Hence, one or more causal primitives will figure prominently in any correct account of causality. And the one I prefer is the scholastic one. And St. Thomas has something very much like this, communicates esse by inaction. So it has to, so the two central notions are there's a communication of being of some sort, and it's through the action of an agent, the agent being someone who's acting by a power. Okay. In addition, this first thesis goes, Okay, so an action is conceived of as the exercise of a causal power, or alternatively as the culmination of a causal tendency. In addition, this first thesis goes hand in hand with the claim that at least some instances of singular causality are observable as such. QED. Okay. I'll return to this point shortly. The second thesis is that the fundamental explanatory principles of natural phenomena are ontologically grounded in natural substances themselves. Though there's some disagreement here among contemporary neo-Aristotelians about exactly how to think of this grounding, I'm just going to take for granted the scholastic view that this grounding includes both formal causal structures stemming from Aristotelian formal causes and irreducible causal powers and tendencies that are tied to those structures. So the world is full of, in Hare and Madden's terms, powerful particulars. That's what substances are, poised to act under the right circumstances. The third thesis is that singular causal facts are metaphysically prior to more general causal facts, such as regularities or uniformities or so-called laws of association. One corollary of this assumption is that causal relations, including deterministic ones, may obtain even in the absence of conditions that would engender causal regularities, at least easily identifiable ones. Both Nancy Cartwright and Paul Humphreys go so far as to assert that because of the multiplicity of interfering factors present in nature, there are, in fact, outside the laboratory, very few regularities of the sort that Humean empiricists have traditionally appealed to. What's more, the regularities that do obtain are mere byproducts of the continuous integration of basic causal structures and tendencies with contingent background conditions of a sort that preclude widespread interference with the normal course of causal processes. I'm going to skip a quote by Cartwright that basically says, look, the ancients looked to the heavens for these sorts of causal regularities. The only other place you'll find them is in the laboratory. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but I'll let her have it. So even though what happens always, or for the most part, to use Aristotle's phrase, is often epistemically crucial for discovering and identifying recondite causal connections in nature, the notion of a causal regularity is not metaphysically fundamental, and hence, in an Aristotelian account of causality, it wouldn't play the role of a primitive. There'd be a place for it somewhere in the superstructure, but it's not the sort of thing you build in at the foundation. Okay. Let's move to the empiricist alternative. With these three theses in hand, I turn now to a broad description of the empiricist alternative. To begin with, it's worth noting that so-called empiricist accounts of causality did not, in fact, originate with Hume or Berkeley or Kant or even with Malebranche, who, though usually classified as a, quote, rationalist, influenced both Hume and Berkeley in their reflections on causality. Malebranche was, in fact, following the lead of those medieval Islamic and occasionalists and some Christian sympathizers who had perceived as a heathen threat to God's sovereignty over nature, as well as a spiritual danger for believers in the Aristotelian attribution of causal powers and actions to natural material substances. The medieval occasionalists made a strict distinction between causality as attributed to God and, in some of their theories, to spirits subordinated to God, such as intelligences and maybe even human souls, and causality as attributed to material substances. God and other spirits are genuine agents exercising genuine causal powers, but they are the only such agents, and their powers are the only such powers. In contrast, our ordinary and ubiquitous attributions of power and action to material substances are strictly speaking false. Whatever truth they might embody is best captured, according to the occasionalists, by a reductive analysis that replaces notions such as causal efficacy, action, and causal power and causal tendency with metaphysically tamer notions such as constant conjunction or counterfactual dependence, which do not presuppose agency on the part of material substances. This is the origin of the idea of a so-called occasional cause, that is, an entity C such that C's presence in the right way in given circumstances is an occasion for God to act in those circumstances as an immediate cause of some characteristic effect E. The relationship between C and E is thus strong enough to reflect E's conjunction with or counterfactual dependence on C, but weak enough not to imply any genuine causal activity or power on the part of C. It's just that in circumstances like this, God steps in to bring about the effect directly. The so-called occasional cause exercises no power at all. It's just the occasion upon which God does whatever he's going to do. Malebranche and Berkeley are full-fledged subscribers to this picture. Their complaint is not with the notions of agency or power as such, but rather with the deleterious theological and spiritual consequences of ascribing agency and power to putative natural material substances. In the hands of Hume, however, the occasionalist critique of Aristotelianism is absorbed into a general assault on metaphysical notions that have a, quote, insufficient basis in sensory experience. By his light, the whole gamut of concepts that enter into an Aristotelian account of efficient causality fail to pass epistemic muster. Regardless of what the humanly inaccessible truth might be about the, quote, as he says sometimes, secret powers of the things in themselves. The legacy of Hume is evident among his contemporary successors. So basically, contemporary empiricism is occasionalism with God pushed out the door, okay, and action along with it, and real causality. Oh. Along with it, okay. Here's Mackey, okay. Mackey says, he asserts that causation is, quote, not anything in which there is an observable necessity or efficacy or agency or power or force or energy or productive quality. He doesn't care. Okay. And if there are some of you lurking out there, you don't care either. I didn't do anything just then. Okay. The empiricists differ from the Aristotelians on two broad fronts, according to Mackey, namely regarding the status of the concept of a cause, or what Mackey calls our idea of causation, and regarding the reality which that concept signifies. I'll deal a little bit with each in turn. What's my limit, Father Raymond, former student?
Maybe 1155-ish.
Okay, I'll try to make it fast here. Okay. On the empiricist view, our ordinary concept of a cause is in some straightforward sense a theoretical or psychological construct that is not formed directly from sensory experience. This claim is shared in common by almost all empiricists, even though they disagree over just what the content of the concept is. For instance, Hume himself believed that our ordinary concept of a cause mistakenly implies an a priori knowable necessary connection between causes of a certain type and effects of a certain type. While Mackey takes this concept to imply simply the counterfactual dependence of the effect on the cause in the relevant circumstances. Be that as it may, it's the claim itself that I wish to focus on, because from an Aristotelian perspective, the idea that causal concepts are theoretical as opposed to strictly observational seems wildly outlandish. What did you see? Did you see me throw it up in the air and catch it? Ah, not so fast. Not so fast. Elizabeth Anscombe tries to capture this Aristotelian sentiment by pointing out that the abstract concept of a cause is inseparable from a vast array of more specific and ordinary action and power concepts, as well as from natural kind concepts. Here's Anscombe. How does someone show that he has the concept cause? We may wish to say only by having such a word in his vocabulary. If so, then the manifest possession of the concept presupposes the mastery of much else in language. I mean, the word cause can be added to a language in which are already presupposed many causal concepts. A small selection: scrape, push, wet, carry, eat, burn, knock over, keep off, squash, make, for example, noises and paper boats, hurt. I hurt you. But if we care to imagine languages in which no special causal concepts are represented, then no descriptions of the use of the word in such languages will be able to present it as meaning cause. For learning to use special causal verbs, says Anscombe, is part and parcel of learning to apply the concepts answering to these and many other substances. As surely as we learn to call people by name or to report from seeing it that the cat was on the table, we also learn to report from having observed it that someone drank up the milk, or that the dog made a funny noise, or that things were cut or broken by whatever we saw cut or break them. Did you see that? I just drank some water. Empiricists are thus committed to much more than simply the claim that the single abstract concept cause is theoretical and not purely observational or empirical. This point is borne out by a close examination of Michael Tooley's criteria for analyzability and hence the theoretical status of causal terms. If one measures Anscombe's list against Tooley's criteria, it's clear that all the terms on Anscombe's list, including ordinary action verbs and natural kind terms, turn out to be theoretical and not observational in the strict sense. And even though Tooley himself distinguishes analyzability from reducibility, which he equates with equivalence and meaning, his main argument for the analyzability of causal terms, a venerable one that goes back at least as far as Al-Ghazali, is wholly consonant with the empiricist program. Quote, even if it turns out that some non-reductionist account of causation is correct, it will still be true that there is no observable difference between a world in which all of the non-causal facts are as they would be if states of affairs were causally related, and a world in which states of affairs in question really are causally related. You couldn't tell the difference. The world in which I really do drink the water is observationally indistinguishable from the world in which everything's the same except there's no drinking of the water going on. So there can't be any properties or relations with which one can be directly acquainted that are associated with causal terms. Consequently, neither causal terms nor nomological terms can be treated as primitive, no matter how familiar some of them may be. To revert to Anscombe's example, Tully's claiming that we cannot be directly acquainted with someone's drinking up the milk, and that drinking up the milk is thus a theoretical expression. To be sure, Tully will admit that we can be trained to observe in the, quote, ordinary non-technical sense of observation that someone is drinking up the milk whenever we are directly acquainted with the non-causal facts that accompany someone's drinking up the milk. Likewise, we can be trained to report that we see an aardvark or a red oak tree. But on Tully's view, this no more proves that drinking up the milk or aardvark or red oak tree is not a theoretical or analyzable expression than the fact that we can learn to report this is sodium chloride proves that sodium chloride isn't a theoretical term. Okay? In short, even though we use causal concepts to make observation reports in the non-technical sense of observation, these concepts are not strictly observational, and so we are engaging in theoretical discourse when we use them successfully. All of this will seem quite astonishing to an Aristotelian, and I hope to any ordinary person. As Anscombe comments, someone who says that we can never observe causality in the individual case is just not going to count anything as an observation of causality. To be sure, Aristotelians will concede that causal derivation, or to use the more precise scholastic formulation, the communication of esse through action, is not observable in exactly the same way or sense in which colors or sounds or smells or other qualities that Thomistic Aristotelians call proper sensibles are observable, for causes along with middle-sized material substances are common sensibles, that is, objects of all the senses taken together, rather than the special objects of single sensory faculties taken by themselves. And Thomistic Aristotelians will likewise concede that on many occasions it will not be obvious just which agents are responsible for given effects. That's why so many of us love those British murder mysteries. But they will insist nonetheless that these concessions do not at all undermine the conviction that observability in the ordinary non-technical sense, as Tully puts it, just is primitive or baseline observability, and that unlike the term sodium chloride, terms such as salt, drink up the milk, cut, push are non-theoretical. Indeed, it is only because we observe causes unproblematically in certain cases that we have so much as an inkling of what we are seeking in the less evident cases. In short, the Aristotelian conviction is that any world in which no one ever really drank up the milk, or in which no physical object ever cut or pushed any other physical object, or in which, strictly speaking, were no aardvarks or red oak trees, etc., would indeed be observably different from the world we live in, even if all the non-causal facts were the same in both worlds. I don't even know what that means or how it could possibly be true. Anyway, okay. And as for the rather breathtaking, I had to get this in because this is such a great quotation from Tully. And as for the rather breathtaking empiricist suggestion that, quote, Aristotle was apparently unaware that there are very serious difficulties concerning the concept of causation, unquote, the ready reply is that Aristotle could hardly be faulted for failing to recognize difficulties manufactured by dubious future accounts of sense perception and causal formation. Concept formation. But beyond that, empiricists have not had much success in saying just what our concept of a cause is. I think I'm just going to skip that part. The interesting thing, the point I want to make just before I move into the next session on causality as it is in the objects, is this, that
they themselves judge their own proposals for accounts of causality by basically Aristotelian intuitions. I mean, basically what they're assuming is something like the Aristotelian conviction that a cause is an active source of some effect, something that produces an effect. And when they put forth their own supposedly empiricist proposals about what causality is, they judge them by Aristotelian standards. Let me give you an example. According to Mackey, now Mackey is the master of the constant conjunction route for analyzing causality. And he comes up with this interesting proposal that C is a cause of E, an effect E, in circumstances F, he calls that a causal field. If C is what he calls an I-ness condition for E and F, I mean, you don't need to grasp this all right now, but it makes rough sense if you sit down and think about it. That is, that C has to be an insufficient but necessary part of a condition that is minimally sufficient, though not necessary for the effect. To put it in a slightly different way, C is a cause of E and F, provided that C is a non-redundant proper part of some generic or uniform condition that's minimally sufficient for E and F. Okay, don't worry too much about the details there. Now, it's clear upon reflection that this analysis is too broad. This, Mackey acknowledges this. This is part of his discussion. Okay, and here's his counterexample to his own proposal. Suppose that it's a stable regularity that workers in London leave for home just after the Hooters. I had to get the word hooter in there, you know, the whistle. The Hooters signaling the end of the workday sound 200 miles away in Manchester. So every day this week this has happened. In Manchester, and all of a sudden you get rush hour in London. And it happens all the time. So according to the first account that Mackey gives, the hooting of the Manchester Hooters is a cause of traffic jams in London. Okay. Now, think about it. I mean, you want to say, well, that's crazy, but of course it's crazy. But why should Mackey say it's crazy? Why doesn't Mackey say, well, that's life. Here's the account. This is all that causality could possibly be. So I'll just bite the bullet. No, but Mackey doesn't say that, does he? Mackey thinks it's a counterexample, just like you do. But why should he think it's a counterexample? It's because he can't trace any causal path, by which I mean series of actions, which would make it plausible for anyone to believe that the sounding of the Manchester Hooters is causing a traffic jam, is a cause of a traffic jam in London, a basically Aristotelian intuition, even though previously he had said that the concept of a cause is a concept of counterfactual dependence. Well, if the Hooters hadn't, you know, for all we know, what is, maybe if he, I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to worry about that. This is the way his discussion goes, though. The way his discussion goes is he meets this counterexample, and he does some fundamental changes in his regularity theory. In fact, the changes are such that it's not clear that an empiricist is entitled to them, but he makes the changes he feels he has to make in order to get around this counterexample. Lewis. Now, Lewis has a counterfactual dependence account. So roughly, C is a cause of E. If E is counterfactually dependent on C, and there are a couple more details. But Lewis can handle the Manchester Hooters and some other obvious counterexamples that Mackey has a hard time with. But he does have a problem with what he calls late preemptions, okay? Here, what is a case of late preemption? C is intuitively a cause of E, but if C hadn't directly caused E, C star would have stepped in to cause E, okay? And C star would have stepped in at the last moment, as it were. So you can't appeal to any other factors. In such a case, not C doesn't counterfactually imply not E. Okay, so in this case, intuitively we say C is a cause of E, but in this crazy case, it's also true that if C hadn't occurred, E would have occurred anyway. Okay? And so according to the analysis, he can't count C as a cause of E, even though our intuitions tell us that it is a cause of E. Our intuitions tell us, where did those intuitions come from? Now, here's Lewis. This is even more puzzling, because Lewis has an account that seems to have handled a whole bunch of counterexamples that regularity accounts were having a hard time with. And so, okay, this isn't the only case he has trouble with, but there are only a couple of sorts of cases left. So why doesn't he say, well, tough, in this case, C isn't the cause of E, even though we have this intuition that it is? Why doesn't he just bite the bullet and say, tough, my theory works for all these other cases, and so you just need to reform your intuitions so that you don't think that C causes E anymore? Why doesn't he say that? Does he? No. He thinks it's a counterexample. Why does he think it's a counterexample? Well, suppose this is C and E. And there's some mechanism operative in this room such that if I hadn't thrown the thing up in the air, it would have popped up in the air anyway. Why doesn't Lewis just say, you weren't the cause in that situation? Okay, I know it looks like you were. Well, of course he's not saying that, because here we go. Intuitively, I'm throwing it up in the air, and you all believe I'm throwing it up in the air. And if we weren't having an abstract philosophical conversation about causality, nobody would have a doubt. And Lewis, despite the fact that he's this really sophisticated philosopher, doesn't want to violate your intuition about this, that I was the cause of this thing going up in the air, even though it would have happened anyway. Right? He's using an Aristotelian intuition as proof that he has to deal with a counterexample. Now, there are more complicated cases. In fact, the second general point is that the empiricists generally lack a sophisticated understanding of the resources that Aristotelians can bring to bear on otherwise puzzling cases. In the longer version of this paper that I've posted on the web, on my website, I give a couple of examples here. I mean, one of the funniest thing is when Mackey attempts to answer Geech and give an empiricist reduction of the notion of a causal power with rather amusing results. But anyway, I'll let you look that up for yourself. And the end of the paper just kind of reflects back again on the deep epistemic pessimism of the empiricists. Let me just read the second last paragraph I've written here. What's interesting about Hume's successors is that they give the impression that we should simply accept the regularities or contingent laws of nature as Luke Tooley calls them, as primitive facts about the world, cosmic coincidences with no source in any power or agency, be it natural or divine. At the very least, no such source is thought to be is to be thought of even as an unattainable ideal object of intellectual inquiry. Von Frassen puts it really strongly. Empiricism, he says, quote, must involve throughout a resolute rejection of the demand for an explanation of the regularities in the observable course of nature by means of truths concerning a reality beyond what is actual and observable, as a demand which plays no role in the scientific enterprise. And we already know what they think observability consists in. This deep pessimism about the powers of reason is no less remarkable for having become so commonplace in contemporary philosophy. Perhaps it's understandable that such pessimism should have emerged historically in reaction to the excessive optimism of some strains of Enlightenment rationalism, but it's nonetheless a far cry from the hopeful sentiment of Plato and Aristotle, who saw intellectual inquiry as an adventure opening up new vistas, including vistas on the divine. The empiricists, with their vaunted tough-mindedness, have succeeded only in embodying the forlorn dictum of Simonides. Contrast this with the attitude of St. Thomas and most other scholastics, who are often disparaged for having placed faith before reason, but who on the whole had much more faith in reason than the empiricists do. That's it. A hand from the back. Is that you, John?
See, like for instance, in Hume and the naturalism, is sort of there's something at stake there, right? I mean, it's really important to understand how we stand in relationship, say, to God, whether it's an overwhelming God or an underwhelming God. It's still there's something at stake in empiricism, and that makes empiricism seem sort of philosophically important for our lives. Right? But
yeah.
At this point, in this stage of late post-modernity, even for people like Mackey and von Frassen and so on. I mean, it's hard to see what's at stake anymore philosophically if the idea is I still have to hold on to an empiricist account, however sort of complicated it gets, in the face of, say, for instance, you were throwing the bottle there. I mean, kissing my son's cheek, right? Caressing his cheek, tossing his hair. I mean, what's at stake such that one will still want to hold on to the view that that's all sort of indistinguishable empirically, if all the early modern concerns have sort of just faded away, or at least don't seem to be on them anymore?
What is it? This is a question about what, the culture?
Well, I said it wasn't a philosophical question.
Yeah.
So far, I might ask genealogical questions within the context. Why be an empiricist?
That may. We should be moving on to more relevant opponents or something like that.
Well, you could say if the question is why be an empiricist, why also should we, if there's no answer to that now, why should we be concerned with being anti-empiricist?
Well, I think the answer to that question, I mean, it may be that we don't need ever to talk about this stuff anymore. I mean, that may be right. Maybe my paper now can close this chapter in the history of contemporary of anti-empiricism at our workshops. And we should get on to other things. I mean, in general, what we're trying to do is to articulate, in part, I mean, this is the way I feel as a Catholic, right? That part of what's going on here is the desire to articulate in as great detail as I can to myself and to my co-believers, well, and yeah, in general, the sort of confidence that we are up to handling philosophically on their own terms the challenges presented to us by competing philosophies. Okay, so that's just a kind of general, that's one aspect of what it is to be an intellectual and play the role of an intellectual within the church. So, and so that's what we do, okay? And in a sense, it's to help ourselves to articulate better what it is we believe, but also to build up confidence both in ourselves and in people who aren't philosophers, believers who aren't philosophers. It's kind of like what St. Thomas was up to in the Summa Contra Gentiles. In the first nine chapters, he basically says, look, I know, here's what philosophy is. Here's what seeking wisdom is. Now, a lot of you aren't going to be able to follow the conversation that goes on after chapter, that begins in chapter 10. Don't worry about it. It's not that every individual has to build up from proofs for God's existence and everything, right? It's perfectly reasonable. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to accept on faith what, in principle, philosophers might be able to prove. And besides, the faith includes lots of stuff that philosophers could never get to. Nonetheless, what I'm going to be doing in the next few volumes here is an important kind of project within the church. It's an important intellectual project. Because what it's meant to show is that we can take on the best challenges of non-believing philosophers and intellectuals. We can take on the best challenges, and we might even be able to convince them in the end, on their own, by their own lights, that at least our claim to wisdom is not self-contradictory, incoherent, provably. Obviously, provably false, etc. So there's a kind of, so that project is there no matter what. Now, it may be that in choosing this topic, or maybe some of the others in the conference, if the criticism is something like this, look, it looks like in philosophy departments, these sorts of issues are losing their ability to attract scholars and researchers because we're into sexier stuff like, you know, the stuff you're reading about in the papers, the more radical stuff. I mean, if that was the question, then, right, okay, so, you know, I mean, we want to cover all the traditional fronts here, but it may be it's time to move on to something else. Is that the, see, I'm...
It wasn't a challenge.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge in the sense that if no one is an empiricist, well, if there are, yeah. Well, you just okay. So I hope I'm helping to nudge them off. You know, I mean, what more can I say? I don't know. Yeah, Jeff. Right.
But there's something I think kind of attractive about it. The idea that your knowledge is something that starts with your empiricism. And I think you notice this. Well, they sort of say
there's no observable difference between certain situations.
That you don't notice that, you assert that.
Yes, that's right. So
okay.
But this seems to me right. So consider this. I think I'm seeing you, a substance, Fred. One of these empiricists, Hume, says, yeah, but if Fred were just a bundle of observable qualities, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And I guess I think, yeah, that seems right. And then they think, okay, now we're in a theoretical context. Let's compare two theories. Both of us have the sensible qualities, but
right.
you have this extra thing, but
right.
it's not doing any work. So let's go with parsimony to the bundle.
And I've already been seduced at that point.
Yeah, now here's what I'm trying to say goes wrong. I think it's right that we can't tell the difference if what we mean by that is we can't exclude that. I mean, I might be in a matrix. I might be having a vivid dream. The mistake is to think if we can't exclude some possibility, we're not actually observing.
Yeah.
In that other situation, I think I'd be observing, but I'd be making a mistake. And then I was tempted to say, we might say the same thing in the causation case.
Mm-hmm.
If Hume's account were right, I wouldn't be able to exclude that. Still, I think I'm... The epistemically appropriate response to my sensory input is that there's a substance there and that he's doing things like throwing up his... So the mistake, I think, is to infer that because there's no observable difference, we're not observing it. Not that there isn't any... Not that we can actually detect an observable difference. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think, I think we're close to a fight that can't be won by either side. I mean, this is a point at which some philosophers in the past have tried to pull out psychological studies, and you try to determine just what it is that we observe and stuff like that. I think it would be really hard to raise children if you didn't have something like the common sense view. These aren't, okay, that's not a theoretical argument, but I'm just thinking, you know, why did you hit your sister? Oh, it just looked like I was hitting my sister. You know, the whole way in which we, I don't know that this counts as an argument, but this is always... You won't find people who begin as empiricists and then become Aristotelians. It has to go in the other direction, as it were. And there's a certain kind of... See, these guys are thought of as humble because they acknowledge the limits of reason, which St. Thomas, of course, also did, but... Oh, let's not be so proud as to think that we can do all of this stuff. But really, sitting underneath this is pride. I don't mean to be attributing sins to others, but when I said it wasn't a mistake when I said there's a difference between people who accept the world of common sense and ordinary language as a given and even a gift on the one hand from the others. I think I think of it as pathological to begin with kind of skeptical stance on it and say, well, you know, really, your fundamental stance toward the world should be one of suspicion. You should be worried about being duped rather than to accept as a gift the idea that your cognitive faculties are fundamentally reliable, innocent until proven guilty. That obviously is not a intellectually compelling argument for someone who's on the other side of the fence here. And that's why I said I don't think there is a definitive... way to win this argument, but one of the things I was trying to do was just to make clear what's at stake here. But when you get down to this fundamental level and think about what's at stake like that, of course, you know, I'm the sort of person who always thought that college campuses would be a lot better off if they were flooded with little kids that faculty members had responsibility for. I don't know about your university, but there isn't a whole lot of that at mine, okay? And it's just that, I mean, sometimes you want to shake people and say, are you a serious adult with serious responsibilities? How could you hold something like this? Well, that's kind of the way, you know, I want to respond here, but of course that's not a philosophical argument, but that's the best I can do. Yo, Bill.
Yes, Fred, thank you. There is a kind of double dimension to the Humean and Kantian critique with respect to natural theology. The one you were talking about was one part, the epistemic pessimism. But both Hume and Kant, and especially I can remember in Kant, argue, well, suppose we had this real notion of causality. There is a proportion always between cause and effect. Therefore, any arguments from effect to some kind of infinite cause, those kinds of arguments just do not work. And that's another thing. I wonder whether you think that that other feature of their arguments, namely the need for proportionality between cause and effect, depends upon notions of cause which you would challenge, or that can it, in a certain sense, that argument, the proportionality between cause and effect, therefore we cannot argue for an infinite cause, that argument stands alone and has to be addressed in a different way.
I'll defer to Ed on that in his, but I don't know, do you take that? There's something along those lines, right, that you take up in the book?
You mean in the forthcoming book?
Yeah, the forthcoming book. Yeah. The idea that the objection that you're never going to get an infinite cause here because there's a lack of proportionality between how does this work? How does it go again, Bill?
Well, this is both in Kant and Hume. They said, well, suppose you had this tradition of cause, there always is a proportionality between cause and effect, and therefore all these arguments which argue for an infinite,
right, you're not going to get an infinite cause from.
A twofold attack upon the traditional argument.
Yeah.
The epistemic pessimism, which you talked about, but then the hypothetical.
Right. The best you'd be able to do is what Cleanthes comes up with, which is a kind of finite God.
Right.
Yeah. I don't. Go ahead, because I don't think that's a really tough argument to overcome.
Yeah. Well, I think the short response to that sort of criticism that you see in Hume and others is that the nature of the sort of classical argument for God's existence, whether it's Thomistic or Aristotelian or Neoplatonic or what have you, is the logic of the argument gets you to something that when you unpack it, you can see it has to be infinite. So if it's pure actuality or if it's subsistent being itself or what have you, that's the logical terminus of the reasoning that gets you to a first cause, then you get infinity as a byproduct. The reasoning is not the kind of reasoning that Hume represents it. I mean, Hume might be correctly representing design argument reasoning. And with respect to design argument reasoning, the objection maybe goes through. But that's not the kind of reasoning that an Aristotle or a Plotinus or an Aquinas is engaging in.
Well, I just wondered whether you thought that the impoverished notion of causality in the epistemic pessimism argument, which is sometimes treated alone.
I'm not. I don't know that I. That would. I don't think I would feel confident enough to make that claim. I think what we're talking about here is really a lot of ignorance. The arguments that they trot out are not the arguments from the tradition of the sort that Ed is talking about, where, as he's putting it, you get the infinite being as a byproduct of the chain of reasoning that gets you to this godlike thing to begin with. And then it turns out that if you have a being that meets that description, then you can reason via the, you know, via remotionis to unlimitedness and perfection. And that's the kind of thing I don't know. I mean, in a sense, they're not responding. Kant, I mean, that's one of the frustrating things about both of them, but especially Kant to me. I mean, if you're going to make this big claim about the impossibility of proving the existence of a perfect being, then you really should be taking the best arguments of the tradition and dealing with them. And he doesn't do that. I mean, and so what are you supposed to do at that point? And he doesn't even seem to understand how the structure of a good natural theology, what it would look like and how you would go about the different things. And it's not as though he didn't have texts that if he really wanted to, he could have studied and you know, to be responsible. So there's a kind of irresponsibility there, I think, that's a little bit annoying.
One last question. Yeah, I was going to... You're not going to find a more hostile critic of empiricism than me, and I agree with what you said about pride underlying a lot of the empiricist project. But to speak on behalf of the fool here, right? I think that the kind of prideful, smartassery, irresponsible attitude you really do see in a writer like Hume and a lot of modern Humeans who don't. You know, there's a sort of glibness about it and a lack of seriousness. I think that's true of a lot of the empiricist tradition. I don't think it's true of the entire empiricist tradition. I think sometimes it is motivated not by pride, but rather as a reaction against pride. I think you said that in Berkeley, for example.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
He is worried about what he takes to be this sort of monstrous construct.
I wasn't really even including Berkeley. I mean, in some ways, Berkeley is a whole different ball of wax. First of all, because he's more like the... I mean, he obviously does believe in real causality and causal power and all of that. And I certainly always put him and Malebranche on one side of the divide here and wouldn't couple them with Hume or Mill or characters
but
of that sort.
Von Fossen, for example, I think a lot of what motivates him is a kind of a desire to promote an intellectual humility. Von Fossen's a Catholic convert, so there's not an...
I know Von Fossen is a Catholic convert. That doesn't make him an intellectual Catholic.
No. I understand. I think the whole... The attempt to wed constructive empiricism to me, I think it's insane. But I don't think the motivation necessarily is...
I understand.
I don't think either of us want to psychoanalyze him or anybody else.
But, yeah, right.
But I think the motivation might be closer to Berkeley's than it is to Hume, say.
Yeah.
So it's
maybe
the motivation might be good.
Well, it's a little bit. I mean, it's a little bit like trying to make good on the end of the dialogues. I mean, people say, "Well, come on, Philo can't be serious. That, you know, God loves people like me more than anybody else because we leave room for faith. You know, that kind of thing." And there might be something wistful even in Hume going on there. And maybe you might say, "Well, Von Fossen would be a more likely candidate to be able to utter words like that with sincerity, like you get at the end of the dialogues." And I guess I'm willing to, and it's not, I'm being a smartass now. I mean, I love this period in the history of philosophy, and I'm fascinated by all these guys, and Leibniz too, and it's just that there was a lot of arrogance going around. I mean, all you have to do is read Kant's famous lecture, "What is Enlightenment?" Right? I mean, I have to put it down. I can only do it. I have to smoke in between. No, vape. I have to vape in between paragraphs. You know, calm myself down. But I, you know, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have started going this route, the casting aspersions route. So I'll grant you that. It's just that it's so hard. I think it's impossible to reconcile the full gamut of Catholic doctrine with this sort of empiricism. Let's put it that way. And I don't think it's that hard to be able to show that. So, but.
Let's give our great thanks to our speaker.